Thank you for joining us. This is Michael Shapiro, the host of Interplay Conversations in Music. And today I'm with Maestro Matthew Kramer, a dear friend and an extraordinary conductor and musician. Hi, Matthew.
It's great to see you, Michael.
Great to see you too. So we'll start in the sense of just talking about being a music director. And you are the music director of two phenomenal organizations, the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra and the Louisiana Philharmonic Orchestra, in two incredible cities, in New Orleans and in Indianapolis. What's the role of a music director these days?
That's a complicated question because it seems to be evolving and continuing to evolve. And of course, it does depend on which particular orchestra you're talking about. For anybody that's tuning into this broadcast that isn't familiar, you know, that typically conductors have two titles, music director and conductor. So conductor refers to everything on the podium that you do with the orchestra, rehearsing, the performances, but the music director aspect, you know, it really requires multiple hats. In Indianapolis, this is very much the typical prototype of an orchestra where I select the repertoire, the guest conductor, guest artists, and, work with the administrative team and board. But here in Louisiana, it's a very different operation because the musicians actually own the orchestra since 1991 when it emerged from the ashes of the New Orleans Symphony. So they have a great deal of say in the repertoire that we select, the guest artists that are there, the guest conductors. So it is a very collaborative approach. But the easy answer to your question here, it's all of the duties that don't actually occur while I'm making music with the musicians on the podium, from fundraising to selecting repertoire, everything I said.
Now, I was 16 years the music director of the Chappaqua Orchestra, smaller orchestra than Louisiana, obviously, but very close to Manhattan. In your case, you are the great orchestra of New Orleans. I can vouch for that. You're just conducting My Frankenstein very recently to a sold-out house. Indianapolis is a different story because there's the Indianapolis Symphony. Mm-hmm. You're the chamber orchestra. So how would you differentiate yourself between the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra and the chamber orchestra?
And you're correct. The ISO has a robust season. I think, you know, over a $30 million budget. The ICO is about $1 million budget. And I am beginning my 11th season there now. And I think that, the vision that we set out on very early in my tenure has continued to establish the ICO as, you know, bona fide professional orchestra in central Indiana. And we've done that by, you know, judiciously selecting a repertoire that the ISO typically wouldn't touch. A lot of new music, a lot of new commissions and consortiums for the small orchestra. We've continued an annual silent movie, which you were part of. And although Frankenstein is not a silent movie, that was our first talking movie. That's one of our most popular endeavors. Of course, we have our healthy supply of Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn. But it's really, I think, the new music that we play, which has helped distinguish us. It garnered us multiple publications in Symphony Magazine, a regional Emmy Award for a major work by our then composer in residence, James Aikman. And then all of these collaborations that we have with local organizations, and not just arts organizations, but the American Piano Awards, the opera, the chorus, obviously, the children's choir, the ACLU. We've worked with the City of Indianapolis, the Sister Cities Program. So we're actively courting new entities in central Indiana to work together, however that might be. Our longest ongoing partnership is with Dance Kaleidoscope, a marvelous modern dance troupe. Every other year, the orchestra is on stage, the dancers are out on stage in front of us, and it's these kinds of collaborations which have brought in new audiences for us, and I think kept our programming so vibrant. So we have about a 10-week season compared to the ICO's 42 plus, 46 maybe it is, but we're doing very different programming, not touching those John Williams movie scores. We're not doing Mahler, obviously, but we're doing repertoire that just either has not been programmed in Indianapolis or, you know, if it was, it was very rare.
Now, I remember being an active conductor and getting scores from composers, like, all the time. Mm-hmm. What do you look for?
I look for established friendships first and foremost. I don't exactly recall how you and I came in touch for Frankenstein, but we hit it off immediately. And I find that, you know, when you have a relationship, a friendship with somebody prior to having scores emailed to you or being shipped, if anybody even does that anymore now, you have extra cause to look a little bit deeper into that music, because it's, you know, we'll be honest, I get at least, 10, maybe sometimes 20 scores within the span of a week for people that, from managers, from composers online, from Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. It's hard to look at everything. But I also kind of follow the national trends, of course, to see whose music is really getting talked about, whose music is exciting audiences or musicians. And I take recommendations, of course, from my colleagues. I think it's just really important for particularly young composers to build relationships with musicians and with conductors, because if your music is presented in a place of friendship, it's much easier to start conversations about how we could work together than if you're just, you know, soliciting or mailing out scores with really no hope of a reply. So that's where I start from. But I've always been surprised. There'll be a score that comes along, somebody recommends to me, a composer I might not know, and I'm just blown away. And we just all have a limited amount of time in our lives. I try to go thoroughly, you know, as best I can through everything that kind of comes across my computer screen or across my desk, but it's difficult. So I cherish the relationships we've established. And obviously talking to you, we have great projects that have emerged from that original Frankenstein performance in Indianapolis. So I think it's important to maintain relationships.
I totally agree. It's about having friendships and fun. You know, when I look at a new score, I do a good number of residencies at colleges, mm-hmm. and I get students who come before me. You know, they may be very talented at Dorico or Finale, used to be, and Sibelius, and those score programs produce very nice looking scores. However, when I speak to students, I often get a kind of deer in headlights look when I talk to them about how many years have they had really strict counterpoint, mm-hmm. 16th century counterpoint, not just, you know, studies of fugue and canon in a semester with some teacher, but how have they worked with a mentor? Mm-hmm. So let's talk about working with a mentor for the conductor. Mm-hmm. I know that you were an assistant conductor to Joanne Folletta, for example, but talk about the mentoring process and how that has changed who you are.
It's essential for a conductor, I think, to have that early process in their career where they can really cut their teeth, they can get the experience that they need, and do it in an environment which is relatively safe. I mean, there's a lot of pressure being on the podium, and particularly if you don't have the skill set, either the emotional skill set or the musical skill set, to deal with that kind of pressure, you can make a lot of mistakes, and mistakes are important to make as part of the growth process. But I find that the conducting profession now has changed considerably from when I came in. I think I was part of the early stage in the early 2000s when David Zinman took over Aspen, had a larger conducting program modeled after the Pierre Menteau School, where he studied with Menteau, and the idea that you play in the orchestra and then you have an opportunity to go stand on the box and, you know, you get your 10, 15 minutes. Since that time, conducting programs have proliferated, not only in the States here, but in Europe. And I find that it's just now a career where there's so much competition, so many people eager to enter the field, that we've kind of lost some sense of understanding about, you know, what really is required of you and what kind of work needs to go into it. And that could be, you can come from anywhere, as you know. You could be a composer and become a conductor. You could be a violinist like myself and become a conductor. Piano or trumpet or any instrument. So there's not, you know, one route to get to the box, but the understanding of the repertoire, the building blocks that make up great orchestral music, the history, the lineage, et cetera, I just feel like many people are being fast-tracked now, you know, wanted to jump in and just do their Bruckner. But, you know, you don't get to do Bruckner right away, or Mahler, or, you know, more than likely, if you're starting off in this country, you're starting off like I did, as an assistant conductor with a smaller orchestra, moving up to a bigger orchestra, and then eventually getting your first music directorship, usually a smaller orchestra again, and then working your way up. But you know, that mentorship that you referred to, particularly the 7 years that I worked with Joanne Folletta, allowed me the opportunity to learn the repertoire, not just studying, but actually conducting it. All the Beethoven symphonies, for example, to watch and observe Joanne and guest conductors in rehearsal. I got great advice early on when you're covering. Imagine what you would say whenever the guest conductor stops. I mean, imagine what it is that you would address in the orchestra and see if that's what the guest conductor or Joanne Ferretta, you know, chooses to start with. And so the observing process is paramount, I think, for a conductor to learn how to talk to an orchestra, to build trust, relationships, et cetera, so you don't make the mistakes that you can't recover from. You know, overbooking yourself because you have opportunity, but then making mistakes, not getting invited back, for example, or not knowing how to write an education concert because that's going to be crucial for you to get an assistant conductor position. So, you know, there's really not one thing that I can focus on except to take your time and to make sure that you're really making the best out of every opportunity that you have when you're on the podium, even if it is an education concert and you feel like you should be doing something bigger. There are things that you can take away from all of those experiences, and it's ultimately a process where we never stop learning. So I'm grateful that Joanne provided me so many of those building blocks that I could take with me.
As you know, she's a dear friend for both of us.
That's right.
I want to talk to you about your violin playing. Mm-hmm. You are a violinist, and you've done a good deal of chamber music and orchestral playing?
That's right. In fact, both of my degrees, Michael, are in violin performance. The second degree, my master's degree, I actually worked with Philip Ruder, marvelous musician. He was the concertmaster of Cincinnati Symphony for 25 years, Dallas before that. And before that, his very first job was with the old New Orleans Symphony before it shuttered. And now it's the, you know, the orchestra which I conducted in its different iteration. Yeah. So his you know, approach to teaching me was the excerpts which we worked on. And I was fully prepared to, you know, take an orchestral audition. I just decided that, you know, at the time I was conducting, whatever audition I won first is what I would become. And it turns out my very first audition was conducting with Akron Symphony in Ohio, and I became a conductor. But I fervently believe to this day that without having studied and played in an orchestra, my conducting would be forever altered. I mean, I had come from every piece that I conduct from the standpoint of what's it like for that last chair first violin who's so far removed from the other side of the orchestra that they might not hear the basses, for example. And so I think it's very important to continue to possess a chamber music mindset when you conduct, you know, to be clear, to breathe with the ensemble, to listen to what you're getting back, to have that sense of, you know, are you with the music when you're conducting, or are you conducting, you know, around the music, in other words. We talked about this, I mean, getting inside the sound of it. And it's not always easy to do, but you do if you remember what it's like from the musician's perspective. And the violin playing, you know, it's 65% of the orchestra, 60-65% of the orchestra is a stringed instrument. And I'm grateful that I know, as a player, all of the sounds and colors and you know, with what string you're playing on and where the bow is, et cetera. It's so important, even if you're not really a string player, to have an understanding of stringed instruments. So it's transformed my conducting, and I'm grateful for that.
Some people talk about in high professional orchestras. As you know, I've been conducting the Royal Philharmonic recently,
right, in London,
and LA Opera and Atlanta Opera and so forth, with these high quality orchestras. But the Royal Philharmonic is in a different league. Mm-hmm. The best orchestras talk about up bow versus down bow, that they can do the same thing either way. I don't believe it. Do you?
It depends. On occasion, I'm convinced by it. I mean, I have markings from my old teacher. I have markings from, you know, the archives that you can find online with the great orchestras, and to go through, you know, the standard repertoire and just compare the bowings with it. And then, you know, you listen to these great legacy recordings of it, and you try to think, all right, are they playing, because you can only hear it, are they playing down bow or up bow there with that? You know, I'm not convinced. There are some things that I just, you know, as a period instrument enthusiast, I'm not total purist. I don't do it on gut strings and short, you know, neck and the old Baroque bows, but no, we take some practice. Yeah, exactly. We take some elements out of that in the lightness and transparency tempi, and there are certain bow strokes which you just have to have from that period. So, you know, it's always an argument, and I always rely on our concertmasters. Even though I'm a string player, there are only some things which I'll do bowings for, which is usually the Viennese classics and Baroque repertoire. I leave the rest to our capable concertmasters who do marvelous work, because I want them to have their buy-in on, you know, they're because they're in charge of the string section. You mentioned London. That's why they're called the leader over there and not the concertmaster, because they really are the leader of the orchestra.
Fascinating. What do you think of free bowing, like Stokowski did?
Yeah, I love it, and I'm terrified to ever implement it. I mean, the only time I use it is in a, you know, a summer concert where you have one rehearsal, and it's called festival bowing. Like, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, okay, well, it's not as tidy as the normal subscription series. But I'm reminded of the movie you might have seen, whether, you know, you like the movie or not, Tar with Kate Blanchett, where she's talking about Mahler and how did you get such a ferocious sound? Well, you know, free bowing, you got to keep them out of the weeds, because it is difficult to get oriented if you're, you know, watching a sea of people in front of you all going the wrong direction. We want to conform as string players, especially if you're sitting in the back. You are always looking for changes, at, you know, the bowings that come from the front desk. So that's a way of saying to your question, I think it really depends on the repertoire. And some places absolutely call for it. If you have to get this huge sound on the G string, just change as needed to maintain that sound. And, you know, other places like a Haydn symphony, absolutely not.
Different story. When, you know, I was, as a kid, I was able to go to many Stokowski concerts. Mm-hmm. I'm too young to have experienced Toscanini. He died when I was six. But I went to many Stokey concerts. And I've spoken to friends who played in the American Symphony. It's just fascinating when you talk about this kind of subject, but you wouldn't want to go hear a Haydn performance by Stokowski. When you're studying a score, let's say of conventional repertoire, not a new score, because a new score you're making your own Matthew Kramer imprint on, mm-hmm. hopefully for posterity. But let's say you're discussing the Pastoral Symphony, the Sixth Symphony of Beethoven. How much, I mean, this, I know the way you study, and you never want to get up in front of an orchestra unless you know the score better than everybody sitting there, which is the basic rule. But when you're studying a score like that that's gone through so many iterations and so many different hands over the years, do you go back and look at historical recordings, the so-called legacy recordings?
I absolutely do. I think it's an invaluable tool. But like you said, you don't get up on the box unless you have thoroughly studied the score, harmonic analysis, put your bowings in, phrase, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, especially in this day and age, I mean, it's been this case for years now that all of this is available with a couple clicks on YouTube. It's all available. And so it would be foolish not to go through and listen to, you know, from Carrion to Bernstein, not necessarily for Beethoven, but and then the historically informed practices, just to see the differences. I mean, not just timings, but articulations, textures. And that's the thing, is that I've changed my mind so many times about how I approach this repertoire. I used to go, you know, oh, faster and lighter is great for Beethoven. But then you go back and, you know, you can listen to some of these marvelous recordings from the Berlin Philharmonic that just convince you otherwise, that you want that depth and that, you know, heaviness in the repertoire. So I think we're entitled to change our minds about it. All I do is I throw my score away, buy another Baron Rider score, and start all over again. And I think that's a refreshing process, you know, of making this music seem new again. Because if you just grab the same old score off the shelf and approach it the same way you did 2 years ago when you last did it, then I think it becomes very stagnant and almost like we're on autopilot with it. So, you know, that's why so many of these composers did record the Beethoven cycles 2-3 times, because they changed their minds about it. Not all of them were successful, but I think it is important that you come later in your studying process to the recordings. You don't begin the studying process with the recordings, but they're a nice tool to have later on.
There's a great story that Carl Bamberger told me. He was very close with Elisabeth Furtwängler, and I actually called Bamberger when I was at the Zurich Opera. He was staying with Elisabeth Furtwängler, and I called the house and she answered, and then I spoke to him. But he told me that Furtwängler had told him this story, that he was sitting studying the Eroica Symphony, and Elisabeth came into the library and she says, "Wilhelm, why are you studying? How many times have you conducted that piece? 60 maybe? Why are you looking at it?" And you know what he said? "I might miss something."
I love the honesty, but that's the truth.
Yeah, he was humble in that way. So going into other things, let us talk about concerto accompanying. Mm-hmm. There's the famous story, obviously, of Glenn Gould and Bernstein doing the Brahms and the Tempi, and we all know that story, and Lenny's speech to the audience before Glenn Gould came out. But how do you approach, let us say it's a new piece of music, and I'm now speaking of my violin concerto, which you are going to premiere in January with Tim Fain. So how do you, and Indianapolis, how do you approach a new piece of music like my concerto at the Shore of the Sea, which has never been played, and we're going to record in Indianapolis? How do you approach it? And you haven't worked with Tim before.
I've not worked with Tim, but I've got the greatest resource for your concerto. I've got you. And that's the great thing about living composers is that you can ask those questions. You know, this transition didn't quite seem to work for me. Would you mind if I take it a little slower here? Or whatever the case may be, you can try different things because there is no legacy, as you mentioned. It's never been performed live. And so, we're discovering this together. Concerto right. accompaniment, particularly, though, I'm much more deferential conductor when it comes to accompaniment. I mean, the story about Bernstein is famous, but I just kind of roll my eyes, typical Lenny, like just, you can hire a different soloist the next time you do a piece like that if it's, it just didn't feel comfortable. But
it was Rudolf Serkin.
That's right. But you have a very important job when you're, conducting concerti or solo works like that compared to a symphony or, an orchestra-only piece is that you do have to align the orchestra with the soloist, and you have to give the soloist the freedom to, to take the rubato where they want to, or to take the chances where they want to. So they're not just phoning it in the same way that they did from the rehearsal to the concert. And it's more challenging, obviously, with new music because there's less known, we're looking at our scores more because chances that it's memorized are probably next to nothing. You don't want to take those chances. So there's a little bit more pressure, I would say, with new works like that, just because it's not as familiar. It's the first time out. And we always gain so much from doing the repertoire the third, the fifth, the 12th time in this case. So, but I look forward to that challenge because, doing new music is a love for me, but particularly the new concerti, because I think it allows now another part of this cycle of life to shine, which is the soloist who, with a soloist like Tim, he'll take the piece with him. And there's much more likelihood I find with concerti that, if you have a powerful advocate in the soloist, that those pieces will be programmed again.
He's also, in my mind, the greatest violinist in the world.
He's amazing.
I know no one like him. And I know all the famous people, but Tim's remarkable, and he's recorded my music twice, and we've had a long relationship. I conducted maybe four or five concerti with him. I'm curious, as a violinist who's played chamber music in his life, you've done string quartets, piano quintets, all that stuff, right?
That's right.
How does that impact the phrasing? Not only rhythm. I mean, look, most of us can do metronomic rhythm, but is that really, really what's necessary? Where's the air? Mm-hmm. Where's the phrasing? How are you bringing this guy, Mozart, over my head? How are you bringing Mozart's phrasing into a piece, at least the way we look at it now? Mm-hmm. For example, I saw Don Giovanni last night at the Met with my dear friend Kyle Kettleson, who's a magnificent. But, I think of Ezio Pinza, I think of Cesare Siepi, I think of his forebears and approaching Mozart in a very different way because they were doing Mozart that was expected to be a certain way in the period when, Cesare did it in the 50s or when Ezio Pinza did it in the 30s. It was a different Mozart. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're looking at Mozart 40. You're doing it with one of your great orchestras. What is the Mozart 40 of today, and how is it phrased? How is that different than the Mozart 40 that was conducted by Toscanini?
Mm-hmm. Well, Toscanini, championed faster tempi, I think, than many of his peers at that time, where things were stodgy and a little slow. And when things are slow, then they have a different sense of gravity, and it's going to affect where you breathe. To your point about stringed instruments, I, have to tell myself, and when I'm playing chamber music, the breath is so critical because we can take our breath wherever we want to. Now, we obviously start pieces with a breath, and that breath tells you the tempo of the character, et cetera, et cetera. But once we're in there, I mean, the bow changes. We don't have to breathe with every bow change the way that an oboist or a singer has to, you know, breathe with the phrasing or where they can try to get the breath in those cases. So I've heard, you know, conductors describe it, you know, you're playing on the breath or, you know, with the breath. So that breathing thing is so important because it gives you so much of the feel of things. But, the tempo is obviously so critical with this. It affects the feel of the music, the textures of it. Personal choice that's in there, the chamber music aspect, if you're doing a Mozart string quartet, well, you're one of four. And so you're going to have to try to work collaboratively to get to a consensus about how you want to approach this. And if you're the first violinist in a Mozart quartet, obviously, you know, your part is much, much, not important, but it's more prominent, you know, with melodies, et cetera, et cetera. So I miss that aspect of chamber music, and it's why I cherish it every opportunity I do have it, because it is, again, very collaborative. It is, you know, stop, discuss. Hopefully you can remain on good terms with each other and not, you know, insult each other when you're, you know, trying to fix something, whether it's intonation or phrasing, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, the phrasing thing is so unique, and it's so difficult to explain to non-musicians because, well, the notes are right there, right? Not necessarily. Where are we going? Where, music is always going somewhere or it's coming from somewhere. Very rarely, it is deliberate when it is, as it's static, not moving and not leading us somewhere. So that fluctuation in tempo, I love those old recordings where there was a fluid pulse. I think that goes back to Wagner, where, you know, there was a sense of, you know, never a consistent beat, that it was always kind of leading us somewhere. And the older I get, the more I'm kind of gravitating towards that, because I was really infatuated with that performance practice where things were fast and just, you know, a whirlwind. But I'm appreciating more and more what, you know, the old guard did when they allowed the music to breathe a little bit more. And, you know, people will always argue, Michael, about Mozart phrasing and Mozart textures and diction and those kinds of things. That's part of the greatness of what we do, is that there are so many different interpretations that are valid.
Yeah. I come from the opera world, as you know, as a coach and with singers. And it's been said of Mozart that he was a vocal composer, an opera composer, which he was. And the symphonies, you know, he knocked them. 39, 40, and 41 were written in 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. He wrote the overture to Don Giovanni in a night. The night before the premiere, I might add, in Prague. And I could just imagine what the copyists were doing in the morning. They had to have been pulling the hair out of their heads or throwing their wigs off, whatever it was. But I mean, when you look at the Mozart 40, again, we have E flat D, right? Da 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 da. There's a rhythm, but there's also a phrasing, and there's a momentum and a tempo. Mm-hmm. So when you're approaching Mozart 40, we'll just talk about his piece. You've got a lot going on at that beginning. You've got kind of a rhythm section in the violas, right? Right? And then this da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da. So what does your background tell you when you're approaching that score? And then how do you impart, conductor, maestro, how do you impart your vision, the Kramer vision, to a collection of who knows how many people? Mm-hmm. How's it imparted?
Well, it's interesting that you asked. I mean, I have Mozart 39 coming up in January. It's, you know, like 40. It's the one great one that I come back. But it's the same point that, you know, I make about 40, which I adore and also conduct whenever I can. You know, the one way that you can do this is to grab the orchestra parts ahead of time and with your librarian, put in anything that you think is essential for the musicians to know. Tenuti over quarter notes, so that they know not to shortchange anything. We did this working with some Baroque specialists, you know, indications and where you want notes to swell or what they call whale tones, if you want to, the indications for how much vibrato to use. I mean, those are all, you know, maybe micromanaging to some extent, but it saves you infinite amount of time in rehearsal, as you know.
Yeah.
So critical with that. And then let's not forget, you know, which sometimes we do when we're conducting, is that it's so important to show the musicians. A simple gesture of, you know, of growth in sound, diminuendo, or, you know, opening your hands up as opposed down, that can create different colors in the orchestra. And it's, you know, you have to remember the kind of tension that you carry or release in your body can be transferred to the musicians if they're watching you grimace. So I'm always reminding myself of this because I forget these things after a while. I'm so focused on what I'm hearing that I'm not focused on what they're seeing. And so you can, again, either show it or you can put it in their parts, but either way, you're going to have to mold this sound. And I always tell younger conductors particularly, be accepting to what comes back at you, because you might find it actually is much nicer than what you were thinking, you know, might have worked. That's the great part of making music with so many great professionals, is that they might surprise you and play it on their own in such a way like you would never imagine. And I'll say that that happened in Salzburg. I was there in 2006 just to observe, you know, the great orchestras. And it was the Mozart year in 2006. The Vienna Philharmonic played everything that Mozart wrote. And I was astounded by, no matter who stood up there on the podium, that they played this symphony like it had already been rehearsed 100 times, which it has for them, let's be honest. Right. They self-policed themselves in a way that was just transcendental.
They can't play French music. they can't. I've heard it live with them. Butcher Ravel, for example.
But they're pretty good at the Mozarts and the Beethovens.
Well, Mozart and Schubert and so forth, Beethoven. And Lenny had issues getting them to play Mahler in the way he wanted. I mean, it's interesting, these great orchestras, what's in their DNA and what isn't. Mm-hmm. What can they do and what can't they do? It's just an ending, Maestro Matthew Kramer, to our interplay conversation in music. I'm always interested in not only from whence you came, and you've told a lot about that, but where you think you want to go.
Oh, it's interesting. I just, you know, what is it? They tell God your plans and, you know, see what comes back. I would never have imagined, honestly, that my life would have taken me here, all the opportunities. I mean, for a conductor, there are so many challenges, so many moments where you just find like it's just not going to work out. There's too much competition. It's just, and some door is always open and you just have to be ready to seize it. But, you know, I'm open to any possibilities going forward. I love the collegial process of making music with great people. And that's what I cherish wherever I've been. And it's important for conductors know, you know, not to overstay your welcome, that it's time to grow, you know, for the orchestra to grow with somebody else and for you to grow with somebody else. So I don't know. I know that my family and I enjoy now our lives here in New Orleans. I'm appreciative for every month that I get back to Indianapolis to make music with those great people. I'm artistic advisor over in Lafayette, Louisiana, for an orchestra there now. So I'm spending time with them. So as long as I can continue to make music with great people, great musicians, and to perform this great variety of living composers as well as the standard repertoire, I'm happy with wherever I am.
Well, I think also I'm blessed with the fact that you're going to record my violin concerto with Tim Fain and also our dog piece, Zoomies.
It's marvelous. I've spent time with both scores, but I'm loving Zoomies. It's terrific. The violin concerto is extraordinary, too. It's going to be a real treat for us.
I can't wait. And the recording will be special because that's another way of getting the message across of what you intend, you know?
Mm-hmm. Very true.
So, Maestro Matthew Kramer, thank you so much for being on Interplay Conversations in Music.
Great talking to you, Michael, as always.
Thank you, audience, and see you on our next visit. This is Michael Shapiro for Interplay Conversations in Music.